I Believe by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful B.C. Chapter 7. Mary Bond felt all fluttery inside, as if a whole load of butterflies had gotten into her somehow. She looked with apprehension from the doctor to her husband, and then to Ellen, who had crept up the stairs behind them. Helplessly, she showed the doctor into their sitting room, where only favored visitors ever went. Father Bond said, "Okay, Ellen, off to your room." The doctor instantly interrupted, saying, "Oh, but Mr. Bond, Ellen is the most interested person in this arrangement. I definitely think that he should be here in this discussion. After all, he's not a child now. He's approaching an age when many others would be at college, and we hope that he's going too." Reluctantly, Martin Bond nodded his head in acquiescence, and the four of them sat down, the mother with her hands folded demurely in her lap. "Dr. Thompson seems to think our boy has got a lot of goods up in his attic," said Martin Bond. "He wants to talk to us about him because he thinks Ellen should become a doctor. I don't know what to say about it." The mother sat still and said nothing. And then Dr. Thompson spoke. "You know, Mrs. Bond," he said, "there are some very strange things in life, and people get impressions that they have to do a thing without knowing why. Ellen here, for instance," he gestured in the boy's direction, "has a very, very strong impression that he has to enter medicine. The impression is so strong that it's almost an obsession. And when we get a boy, or a girl either for that matter, who insists on a special career almost from the first words they can utter, then we have to be convinced that the good Lord maybe is getting a message through, or is trying to work a miracle, or something. I don't profess to understand it. All I know is this. I was an orphan. I was brought up in an orphanage, and, to put it in its mildest form, I had a very hard life in the orphanage, because the people there thought I was different in some ways, because I too had a definite vocation, and that was that I should enter medicine. Well, I did enter medicine, and now I'm doing quite well at it." The parents sat still, their brains almost obviously clunking over as they tossed thoughts around inside their skulls. At last, Martin Bond said, "Yes, doctor, yes, I agree with everything you say. The boy should have his chance in life. I had none neither, and I'm fighting to pay the bills. But tell me, doctor," he looked really hard at Dr. Thompson and continued, "we are poor people. We have a hard job to pay our bills every month. And if we don't pay our bills every month, then we don't get our supplies. And if we don't get our supplies, then by golly, we're out of business. So tell us, how are we going to provide for Ellen? We can't afford it, and that's all there is to it." Martin Bond slapped his knee vigorously to emphasize that here was fini, the end, and all the rest of it. Ellen sat there downcast, looking glummer and glummer. "If I was in the USA," he thought, "I'd be able to take a part-time job and study the other part-time, and I'd get through that way. But this country, well, There doesn't seem much hope for poor lads like me. Dr. Reginald Thompson was thinking, too. He put his hands in his trouser pockets and stretched out his legs, and then he said, "Well, as I told you, I've had a hard life, and I've done what I believe I had to do. Now, it may be that I've got to help Alan, and so I'll make this offer to you." He looked around to see if they were paying attention, and indeed they were. Alan was looking straight at him. Father Bond was looking less dour, and Mother Bond had stopped fiddling with her fingers. Satisfied with what he saw, the doctor continued, "I'm a bachelor. Never had any time for the women, you know, been too interested in study and research and all the rest of it, so I stayed a bachelor, and I've saved a lot of money by doing so. I am prepared to invest some of that money in Alan, if he can convince me that he really will make a good doctor." Mary Bond said, "That would be a wonderful thing, Doctor. We tried to take out an insurance policy which would help Alan pay expenses, but there was no such policy suitable to people of our means, or rather the lack of means." The doctor nodded silently, and he said, "Well, he's all right in the educational line, because the headmaster of his school spoke very highly indeed about him, and he has a free scholarship to enter St. Maggot's pre-med school, just the same as I had, but that doesn't pay his living expenses, and it would be better for him to live in college. And it doesn't pay for various other expenses. So this is what I'll do." He sat there, sucking in his cheeks and blowing them out, and then he turned to Alan and said, "This is what I'll do, Alan. I'll take you to the Hunterian Museum up at the Royal College of Surgeons, and we'll spend a day going through the museum, and if you can stick it out without fainting or anything, then we can be sure that you will make a success as a doctor." He was silent for a few moments and then continued, "I can take a step more than that. I can take you to a dissecting room where they have bodies and bits of bodies all over the place. If you go and be sick all over them, then you're out of the doctor line. If you can convince me, okay, we'll have a partnership. You've got your scholarship. I'll pay all the expenses. And when you are a qualified doctor, able to pay back, then you do the same for some other unlucky soul who is trapped between what he knows he has to do and his inability to do it through lack of money." Alan nearly fainted with relief and happiness. But then Father Bond said slowly, "Well, now, Doctor, we rely on the boy to do our deliveries for us, you know. We've kept him all this time. It's only right he should do something for us. And if, as you say, he's going to be stuck away somewhere in some college, living in luxury, then what about his poor parents? Do you think I'm going out after hours and deliver?" Mrs. Bond looked shocked and said, "But Martin, Martin, surely you remember that we managed before Alan came on the scene?" "Yes, of course I know," said Martin angrily. "I'm not likely to forget. but I'm also remembering all the boy's been to us all these years. We've had to provide for him, and now, when he's had all he can get from us, he's going to rush off and be a doctor, if you please, and I suppose that's the last we'll ever see of him. Huh. Martin Bond's hands were working together as if he was longing to strangle somebody, and then he burst out, "And what do you get out of it, Dr. Reginald Thompson? Why have you suddenly taken such an interest in this boy? That's what I want to know. People don't just do things for others, you know, unless they've got some motive behind it. What are you getting out of it?" Dr. Thompson laughed out loud and then said, "My goodness me, Mr. Bond, you've convinced me that your son is quite exceptional. All you think about is what you can get out of things, and all he thinks about is how he can help others by being a doctor. You want to know what I'm getting out of it, Mr. Bond? Well, I'll tell you. I have impressions, just the same as your son has impressions. I have the strongest impression that I've got to help him. Don't ask me why, I don't know why. But if you think that I am after him sex-wise, well then, Mr. Bond, you're a bigger fool than I thought you were. I can get plenty of boys and girls, too, if I want them. But this time, I want to help Alan for the sake of something that I know, something at the back of my mind and won't come forward. But if you don't want to have him helped, Mr. Bond, then we will wait until he's 21, and although it will be a bit late, well, we'll take it from there. Now, I'm not here to argue with you. If you don't want to go on with this, say so, and I'll get out." Dr. Thompson got to his feet, looking a very truculent individual indeed. His face was red, and he looked as if he would like to throw Martin Bond through his own front window. Martin Bond twisted his hands about, and he fiddled with the end of his jacket, and then he said, "Well, maybe I was a bit hasty in what I said, but I'm wondering how we can manage to get the spuds taken out at night and things like that. We've got to live, you know, as well as the boy." Mary Bond broke in very hurriedly, "Oh, shush, Martin, shush. We can arrange that all right. We can soon get a schoolboy come along and do it for us. It won't cost much. It won't cost as much as keeping Alan here." Mr. Bond slowly nodded his head. "All right, all right," he said with some reluctance. "You can go. You're not 21 yet, and I still have control over you. And you make a success of that doctoring job you're going to do, or you'll hear about it from me." With that, the father turned abruptly and clattered down the stairs to the shop. Mary Bond turned apologetically to Dr. Thompson and said, "I'm so sorry about this, doctor. My husband sometimes is a bit impetuous. He's an Aries, you know." So it was arranged. Dr. Thompson would take Alan to the Hunterian Museum on his day off next week. With that arranged, the doctor went home and Alan returned to his room to study. "Hello there, Alan," said Dr. Thompson, as Alan presented himself at the surgery a week later. "Come on in, we'll have a cup of tea. Then we'll get in the car and off we'll go to Lincoln's Inn Fields." They had their tea and some biscuits, and then the doctor said, "You better go in there, boy. All the excitement might stir you up, and I don't want you taking a leak in my nice clean car." Ellen blushed and hurried off to the littlest room where, we're told, even a king must go on foot. Dr. Thompson led the way out around a path going along the back of his house. There he had his car parked, a good old Morris Oxford. Unlocking the doors, he said, "Get in," and Ellen thankfully got in the passenger seat. Ellen was not very used to private cars. All his traveling had been done on clattering trams or rattling buses. He watched with avidity as the doctor started the engine, waited a few moments for it to warm up, and then checked the charge rate and oil pressure and drove off. "Do you know the best way to go, Ellen?" asked the doctor quizzically. "Well, sir," replied Ellen, "I've looked it up on a map, and all I can say is you go along the East India Dock Road and then go over London Bridge, and I suppose we have to go over Waterloo Bridge as well." "Nope," said the doctor. "I got you this time. We're not going to cross any bridges. You follow the route carefully, because if my plans come right, you'll be doing this journey quite a few times." Ellen was quite enthralled, looking at all the places outside his own locale of Tower Hamlets. He had not been able to move about much, and yet he had a most uneasy feeling that many of these districts through which they were driving had been well known to him at some time. At last they turned right and went up Kingsway in Holborn, up Kingsway for quite a distance, and then they turned into Sardinia Street, which led to Lincoln's Inn Field. Dr. Thompson suddenly drove through some iron gates to the right and parked his car smartly. Switching off the engine and taking out the keys, he said, "Here we go, lad, out you get." Together, they walked into the entrance of the Royal College of Surgeons building, and Dr. Thompson nodded with easy familiarity to one of the uniformed people standing inside. "Okay, Bob?" he asked one of them, and then, nodding cheerfully, he went on into a dark entrance lobby. "Come on, we turn left here. Oh, wait a minute, I forgot. I've got to show you this." He stopped and grabbed Alan's arm, saying, "Now, here's something which will make your teeth ache. Here are some early dental instruments. Do you see them there in that glass case? Now, how would you like to have had your molars yanked out with things like that?" He slapped Alan playfully on the back and said, "Okay, come on, let's get in here." Here was a large space, quite a large space, littered with cabinets and closets and, of course, shelf after shelf of glass bottles. Ellen looked about at the bottled babies, floating fetuses, and all the extremely peculiar organs which surgeon had thought it advisable to save for the purposes of examination and student tuition. They walked down one room and stopped at a well-polished walnut case. Dr. Thompson pulled out a drawer, and Ellen could see that it was two sheets of glass sandwiched together, and inside, between the two sheets, was an awful mess of something. Dr. Thompson laughed and said, "This cabinet represents a brain which has been sliced up so that you can open a drawer and look down and you can see any particular part of that brain. Look at this." He reached for another drawer, pulled the handle, and out came another glass sandwich, and the doctor pointed at it, saying, "That is supposed to be where you get psychic impressions. I wonder what's going on in yours." And then he added, "I wonder what's going on in mine, too." The doctor and Alan spent all morning in the Hunterian Museum, and then Dr. Thompson said, "Well, I guess it's time we had something to eat, don't you?" Alan had been feeling rumbling pains, and he nodded as he thoroughly agreed. So they left the museum and got in a car and drove off to a club where Dr. Thompson was obviously well known. Soon they were sitting at a table having lunch. "After this, we'll go along to a hospital, and I'll take you into a dissecting room, and we'll see what we can see there." "Oh, can one just walk into a dissecting room like that?" asked Alan in some astonishment. Dr. Thompson laughed and said, "Oh, dear me, no, of course not. But I'm known as a specialist, and I had a place in Harley Street for some time. But I just couldn't stand all the bowing and scraping there. I couldn't stand a lot of the old matrons who thought if they paid enough money, they would be cured immediately. And anyway, they treat doctors as the lowest form of life," he said as he finished his meal. Soon, the car drove up to a hospital entrance and parked in the space reserved for doctors only. Dr. Thompson and Alan got out and walked into the main entrance to a reception desk. Dr. Thompson went forward and said to one of the staff there, "I want to speak to Professor Dromedary Demkoff," he said. The attendant turned away and spoke into a telephone, returning to Dr. Thompson and saying, "Yes, sir, the professor has asked me to bring you and your visitor to him. Will you come this way, please?" Together, they walked through hospital corridors for what, to Alan, seemed to be endless miles. At last, they reached an office with the professor's name on the outside. The attendant knocked and pushed the door open. Dr. Thompson and Alan entered. The first thing they saw was half a human on a table, and two people in white coats were busily cutting down into it. For a moment, Alan felt strange things happening inside him. But then he thought quickly that if he were to be a doctor, he would have to become used to sights like this. So he swallowed quickly, closed and opened his eyes two or three times, and then everything was all right. "This is the boy I told you about, Professor. He's good stuff, you know," said Dr. Thompson, introducing Alan. The professor gazed at him and said, "Ach, right it is that you may be already. We shall see what we shall see, eh?" And then he broke into such a girlish chuckle that poor Alan felt highly embarrassed. For some time, they just stood there chatting while the professor watched the two students at work. And then Alan was taken down to a dissecting room, a huge room, remarkably cold and frightfully smelly. For a moment, poor Alan thought he was going to disgrace himself by either fainting or vomiting on the floor, but again he remembered that he had a job to do, and the spasm of nausea quickly passed. The professor moved from body to body. It was not lecture time, so no students were here, pointing out various things of interest, and Dr. Thompson was closely observing Alan's reaction. "Ach, the dunder-headed fool!" exclaimed the professor angrily, as he stooped down and picked up a severed arm, which had dropped off a table and rolled beneath it. "Oh, students nowadays, they are not as they were in Germany. They are so careless. How would they like to have an arm dropped?" Mumbling to himself and grumbling away, he moved to another body and, reaching out a hand, caught Alan by the arm and said, "Take that scalpel and make an incision from here to here. You should know what cutting flesh is like." Alan numbly took the proffered scalpel, and then, with an inward shudder which he hoped was not too obvious, he pressed the point of the knife onto the dead flesh and pulled it down. "You have the touch! You have the touch!" said the professor excitedly. "Yes, you will be all right as a medical student." Later, Dr. Thompson and Alan had tea, and the doctor said, "Well, now, so you can still eat, in spite of all you've seen. I half expected to see you rolling under the table, green in the face or something. What are you going to do when you get kidney on toast next time? Throw it up?" Alan laughed. He was very much more at ease now, and he said, "No, sir, I feel quite at home." Slowly they drove back to Wapping through the evening crowds, Dr. Thompson talking all the time, saying what he wanted to do, how he was getting old and he was tired, saying how he would look after Alan and provide him with his own bank account so that he would be independent of his parents. He said, "I never knew my parents. I was an orphan. But if my parents had gone on like your parents did, well, believe me, I think I should have run for it." That evening, there was great talk in the Bond household. Father Bond was trying not to show his interest, but at the same time, he was listening with avidity to everything being said. And then, at the end, he said gruffly, "Well, you can go when you like, lad. We've found a boy to take over when you leave us." And so, speedily, it was all arranged. Alan was to go to the pre-med school of St. Maggot's Hospital, and after that, if he was successful, he would become a medical student at St. Maggot's. And Alan was successful at pre-med school. He did well. He was of the first three and became a well-favored student, beloved of his tutors. And then the time came for him to leave pre-med and enter the hospital as a proper medical student. He did not really look forward to that which was to take place on the next day, because change is ever strange, and there had been many, many changes in Alan's life. St. Maggot's was an old hospital built mainly in the shape of a U. One arm of the U was for medical cases, and what would be the bottom of the U was for psychiatric, pediatric, and similar, while the other arm of the U was for surgical cases. Of course, Alan, during his pre-med studies, had been into the hospital on many occasions, but it was with a decided feeling of trepidation that he went there on that first Monday morning. He went up to the main entrance and said who he was, and the attendant sourly remarked, "Oh, one of them, eh?" Then he turned to a ledger and took his time fumbling through the pages, licking his thumb and leaving decided nicotine stains on the paper. Then at last he straightened up and said, "Oh, yes, I know all about you. Go straight up them stairs. Turn right, turn left, and it's the second door on the right. It's Dr. Eric Tetley that you have to see, and you'd better be careful. He's in a poor mood this morning." With a shrug of his shoulders, the attendant turned away. Alan paused for a moment in some astonishment. He thought there should be a bit more respect for a man who was going to serve in the hospital for 3 or 4 years as a medical student. But he, too, shrugged his shoulders, picked up his cases, and walked up the stairs. At the top of the staircase, in a little vestibule around to the right, there was a table and a man was sitting at it. "Who are you?" he asked. Alan identified himself, and the attendant checked through the book and then wrote something on a card, saying, "You can leave your cases here. Just take this along to Dr. Eric Tetley's office. Knock once, not too loud, mind, and then enter. What happens next is up to you." Alan thought this was a most peculiar system of dealing with new entrants, but he took the card from the man and went to the office as directed. He knocked, waited a discreet second or two, and then quietly entered. There was a desk littered with papers, surgical instruments, and photographs of women. A black nameplate, lettered in white, "Dr. Eric Tetley," stood on the corner of the desk, and the doctor himself sat square in an office swivel chair. He had his arms out wide, big, fat hands spread out on the edge of the desk. Alan walked forward to the desk, being somewhat unnerved by the unmoving stare of Dr. Tetley, and then he said, "Sir, I have come to join St. Maggot's. I have to give you this card." The doctor made no move to take it, so Alan put it on the desk in front of him and stood back under that quite unnerving stare. "Huh," grunted the doctor. "Yes, old Thompson was right. I think you've got the makings of a good man in you. But you need straightening out a bit, eh?" Then he raised his voice, not in song, but to bawl. "Paul! Bond is here. Come in, will ya?" Only then did Alan see that the doctor had his finger now pressed on a button and was using an office intercom system. Soon there was a flurry of noise and a small, untidy-looking doctor, with hair all over the place, bounced into the room. He had on a white coat, which reached down to his ankles, and his sleeves were so long that they had to be rolled up and rolled again. He did look a rag bag of a doctor. "Oh, so this is Bond, eh? What am I supposed to do with him? Kiss him?" Dr. Eric Tetley snorted and said, "You get a go at him first. You've got to make a good man out of him." Dr. Paul grunted as he leafed through Alan's papers and said, "Oh, so now St. Maggot's has come down to this, eh? We've got the son of a spud seller who's going to be a specialist surgeon or a practicing physician or something. What do you make of that? No more old school ties. Spud sellers, wah!" Alan was shocked. He really was shocked, down to the core of his being, to think that this gruffy, untidy-looking wretch could say such unkind things. But he was there to learn, he thought, so he said nothing. But then He turned to look at Dr. Paul and saw the twinkle in the gray eyes. The doctor said, "But there it is, boy. They say that Jesus was the son of a carpenter, don't they? Don't place much faith in him myself. I'm a good follower of Moses." And with that, he laughed and held out his hand. Shortly after, Alan was shown to a room right up in the center tower of the building, right over the main door. He had to share that with two other student doctors, and the conditions were cramped in the extreme. All they had to sleep on was canvas camp beds. The attendant, who had shown him to the room and let him put his cases down on the bed, said, "Okay, Doc, now I've got to take you to the Maristow ward over in the medical wing. That's a 35-bed ward, by the way, with two beds in a private room attached. Sister Swain is in charge, and boy, oh boy, is she ever a battle axe. Mind your P's and Q's there." Sister Swain, in charge of the Maristow ward, did indeed appear to be a formidable dragon. About 6 foot tall, about 200 pounds in weight, she scowled at everything and everybody. Her skin was so dark that she looked almost like a half-caste, but she came from a very old English family, and it was astounding to Alan when she opened her mouth and spoke, and the voice was one of the most cultured people he had ever met. But familiarity with Sister Swain soon showed she was no dragon, and when she saw that a student was working hard, then indeed she went out of her way to help that student. For shirkers, she had no time whatsoever, and really hastened to the matron's office to report a student who fell down on the job. A medical student's life in a hospital is always much of a muchness, much the same. Alan worked hard. He loved to work, and he made a very favorable impression. At the end of his third year, he was called in by Dr. Eric Tetley. "You're doing well, my boy. Better than I thought you would. I thought first, no matter what old Thompson said, you'd be back scrubbing the spuds, but you've got a good record all the way through, and now I want you to be my personal assistant in the coming year. Do you want to take it?" He looked up at Alan, and not waiting for a reply, he said, "Okay, take a half a day off and go and tell old Thompson from me that he was right. I owe him a case of," he said. Alan walked to the door and then was called back. "Hey, you, wait a minute." Alan turned back, wondering what was happening now. And then Dr. Tetley said, "You got a car?" "No, sir," said Alan. "I'm just an ex-spud seller turned medical student. I can't afford a car." "Hmm," grunted Dr. Eric Tetley. "Well, I suppose you can drive?" "Oh, yes. Dr. Thompson taught me, and I've got my license." "Well, then," said Dr. Tetley, fiddling about in the right-hand drawer of his desk, mumbling about and saying shocking words as he turfed out all manner of papers and instruments, etc. At last, pouncing with glee upon a ring with two keys attached, "Here it is, the key to my car. I want you to drop a parcel in to a lady. Here's the address. Can you read that writing?" "Well, okay. Drop this in to her, and don't stop and have any chit-chat with her, mind you. Go straight on to old Thompson. Be sure you're back here by 9 o'clock tonight. My car's in Bay 23. That's just below the matron's office." Oh, he said, I better give you a note saying that you can take the car. Otherwise, some bally copper'll come and along and pinch you for stealing it or something. I had it happen once before. He scribbled something on a piece of paper, put his official stamp on it, and then thrusted at Alan, saying, Now beat it. Don't come around here until 9 o'clock tonight. The years went by. Years of great success for Alan Bond, but years of trouble as well. His father died. He'd had an attack of rage one day and just dropped dead in the shop because a customer was complaining about the price of asparagus. So Alan had to provide for his mother because there was nothing left worth selling in the shop. And, of course, the property had been rented. So Alan put his mother in a couple of rooms and made sure that she was adequately looked after. Unfortunately, his mother took a violent dislike to Alan, saying that he had killed his father by running out on him and trying to live in a station above himself. So, apart from providing for her, Alan never went to see her. And soon there came talk of war. The awful Germans, as was the awful Germans' wont, were saber-rattling again, and boasting with all their bumptious brashness of what they were going to do to the rest of the world. There came the invasion of this country and the invasion of that country, and Alan, now a fully trained doctor with M.D. after his name, tried to join up, but he was deferred because of the good work he was doing in his locality and for shipping companies near the Pool of London. One day, Dr. Reginald Thompson phoned Alan at the hospital where he was now on the hospital staff and said, Alan, come over and see me when you've got a few moments, will you? I want to see you urgently. Alan, of course, looked upon Dr. Thompson with real love, so he soon arranged with the aging Dr. Tetley to go off for the rest of the day. Now he had his own car, and soon he was back parking his car in Dr. Thompson's driveway. Alan, said Dr. Thompson, I'm getting old, my boy. I haven't much longer to live. Give me a check-up, will you? Alan stood there in stupefaction, and then Dr. Thompson said again, What's wrong with you, boy? Have you forgotten you're a doctor or something? Get with it, will you? And he started taking off his clothes. Alan soon got hold of Dr. Thompson's instruments, ophthalmoscope, blood pressure apparatus, and all the rest of it, and of course, he always carried his own stethoscope. A check of Dr. Thompson revealed hypertension and acute mitral stenosis. You better look after yourself, said Alan. You're not in such good shape as I thought. Why don't you come on into St. Magot's, and we'll see what can be done for you. No, I'm not coming into that flea-ridden dump, said Dr. Reginald Thompson. What I want to do is this. I've got a very successful practice here. It brings in a lot of money. So, Tetley tells me that you work for him very well and have done for 5 years. And I say now is the time for you to take over my practice while I'm here to help you and to show you the ropes. You've been stuck in St. Magot's so long that you're getting round shoulder and you're almost myopic. Snap out of it and come and live with me." And then he said, "Oh, of course I shall be leaving this practice to you, and until I kick the bucket, you and I can work as equal partners, okay? Shake on it." Alan felt quite upset. He had been, for some time, definitely in a rut. He's got an obsession, the obsession that he had to save life at all costs, no matter how sick, no matter how incurable the patient. Alan was not much good as a surgeon. He had no interest in that. But ordinary medicine, that was his forte, and he was on the way to making a big name for himself. And now his friend and benefactor, Dr. Reginald Thompson, wanted him to enter private practice. The doctor broke in on his thoughts, saying, "Go back to St. Maggot's, talk about it with Eric Tetley, and ask your friend Dr. Wardley what he thinks about it. You can rest assured that that pair will give you honest advice. Now, get out of my sight until you've made up your mind. You're looking almost seasick there." Just then, Mrs. Simmons, now quite elderly, came in with the tea in a wooden trolley, saying, "Ah, Dr. Thompson, I saw that Dr. Bond was here, so I thought I'd save you the trouble of shouting down the hall for the tea. Here it is." And she smiled broadly at Alan, who was now very much her favorite for the good job he was making of his life. Back at St. Maggot's, Alan was able to discuss things with Doctors Tetley and Wardley. Dr. Wardley said, "Well, I shouldn't be telling you this, Alan, but Reginald Thompson has been a patient of mine for years. He's been having a series of cardiograms, and he could go out like a light. You owe everything to him, you know. And you'd better think seriously if you shouldn't go to him." Dr. Tetley nodded his head in agreement and said, "Yes, Alan, you've done a good job here at St. Maggot's, but you're too limited. You're becoming too institutionalized. We're going to have a war, and it needs somebody to get out there in the streets. We can always call you back in emergency. I'll release you from your contract." And so it came to pass that a month later, Dr. Alan Bond became an equal partner with Dr. Reginald Thompson, and they made a very successful practice. But all the time, in the papers and on the radio, there was talk of war, talk of bombings, reports of the failure of one country after another to withstand the attacks of the hated Huns, who, with typical Boche brutality, were sweeping across Europe. At last, Neville Chamberlain returned from Germany with a lot of inept, inane, asinine talk about peace in our time. And from Germany, of course, there came reports of loud, raucous laughter at the lanky Englishman who had come there with his furled umbrella, thinking that he could settle the peace of the world. Soon after, a ranting Hitler went on radio, full of brash bombast, and a day or two after, England declared war. Months rolled by, and the war was not getting anywhere. It was the period of the phony war. One day, a policeman came to Alan, carefully ascertained that he was Dr. Alan Bond, and then said that his mother, Mary Bond, had committed suicide and the body was now in the Paddington mortuary. Alan was shocked, almost out of his mind. He did not know why, but this was the most terrible thing he had ever heard. Suicide. For years he had been preaching against suicide, and now his own mother had committed such an insane act. Soon there came a stepped-up war with bombs dropping on London. All the time there were reports of German successes. The Germans were winning everywhere, and in the Far East, the Japanese were sweeping all before them. They took Shanghai. They took Singapore. Again, Alan tried to join one of the services, and again he was rejected, being told he was of more use where he was. The raids became worse. Night after night, German bombers came across the coast and made for London. Night after night, the dock areas were bombed, and the east end of London was set afire. Alan worked very closely with the ARP people, the Air Raid Precautions people, and indeed had an ARP post in the basement of the house. Night after night, the raids continued. Fire bombs rained down. Thermite bombs bounced off the roof, and sometimes going right through to set an entire house on fire. There came the night of a very bad raid indeed. The whole area seemed to be on fire. The wailing, moaning of the sirens went on continuously. Hoses from fire appliances snaked over the roads and made it impossible for the doctors to use their cars. The night was a moonlit night, but the moon was obscured by the red clouds going up from the fires, showers of sparks flying about everywhere, and all the time the hellish scream of falling bombs, some fitted with sirens to their tail fins to increase the din and increase the terror. Alan seemed to be everywhere, helping pull bodies out of wrecked shelters, crawling through holes which had been forced in basements to bring relief from pain to shattered bodies inside. On this particular night, Alan stood getting his breath and getting a cup of tea from one of the emergency canteens. "Whew!" The ARP with him looked up and said, "That was a close one." Alan looked away and saw the whole skyline in flames. Billowing smoke was everywhere. Above it all, there came the thrum, thrum, thrum of the uneven, unsynchronized engines of German aircraft. At times, there came the chatter, chatter, chatter of British night fighters shooting their machine guns at the invaders outlined by the fires below. There was a sudden woof, and the whole world seemed to tilt. A whole house leapt up in the air, disintegrated, and came down in pieces. Alan felt screaming agony envelop him. The air raid warden, who was untouched, looked around and screamed, "Oh my God, the dock's hit!" Frantically, the ARP men and the rescue squad tried to pull blocks of masonry off of Alan's legs and lower abdomen. Alan seemed to be in a sea of fire. The whole of his being was apparently being consumed by running fire. Then he opened his eyes and said weakly, "No point in bothering with that, man. I'm finished. Just let me be and go on and look for someone not so badly injured." With that, he closed his eyes and lay there for a time. He seemed to be in a peculiar state of ecstasy. "This isn't pain," he thought to himself, and then it occurred to him that he must be hallucinating because he was floating above himself upside down. He could see a bluish-white cord linking his body in the air to the body on the ground. And the body on the ground, he saw, was completely smashed from the navel down. He was just a smear, as though raspberry jam had been spread on the ground. And then it flashed across his mind that today was his 30th birthday. With that, the silver cord seemed to wither and fade, and Alan found himself floating up, just as though he were in one of the barrage balloons, floating above London. He floated upwards. He could see shattered London receding from his gaze. He was upside down. Suddenly, he seemed to bump into a dark cloud, and for a time he knew no more. 53! 53! A voice seemed to be calling into his head. He opened his eyes and looked about, but everything was black. He seemed to be in a black fog. Then he thought to himself, "I don't know about this. It seems familiar somehow. I wonder where I am. Must be having an anesthetic or something." And as he thought about that, the black cloud became gray, and he could see shapes, moving figures, and then it all came back to him. He was in the astral, so he smiled. And as he smiled, the clouds, the fog, and the mist all vanished, and he saw the glory of the real astral plane. About him were his friends, for only friends could be on such a plane. He looked down at himself with shock for a moment, and then hastily thought of the first garment he could think of, the white coat he had used in St. Maggot's. Instantly he was clad in a white coat, but he was shocked for a moment at the gales of laughter which greeted him. Then he looked down and remembered that his last white coat had been waist length, because in the hospital he'd been a specialist. The real astral was very, very pleasant. Alan was taken off by joyous friends to a rest home. Here he had a room which was a very pleasant room indeed. He could look out onto the glorious parkland with trees such as he had never seen before. There were birds and tame animals wandering about, and no one harmed any other creature. Alan soon recovered from the trauma of death on earth and rebirth into the astral, and then, a week later, as was always the case, he had to go to the Hall of Memories, where, alone, he sat and watched everything that had happened in his last life. At the end of that period of time, which could not be measured, a gentle voice said from somewhere, "You have made good. You have done well. You have atoned. Now you may rest here for a few centuries before planning what else to do. Here you can do research or anything you wish. You have done well." Alan walked out of the Hall of Memories to be greeted again by his friends, and together they went off so that Alan could find a home where he could enjoy himself and think what would be the best to do. I believe that all people, no matter who they be, should be taught that there is no death, only transition, and when the time of transition comes, a beneficent nature smooths the way, eases the pain, and makes conditions tranquil for those who believe. End of chapter 7.